This is the Ultra Running History Podcast. I'm your host, Davy Crockett. Thanks for coming. This is episode 177. This weekend, the north rim of the Grand Canyon opened for the season. Thousands of hikers and ultra runners make their pilgrimage to the canyon to hike or run across the amazing wonder of the world. I have been producing short videos for the new Grand Canyon History YouTube channel. I thought it would be interesting to also publish these as a podcast episode for you to listen to. The video versions of these shorts, of course, have many historic pictures to see. Please check them out on the Grand Canyon History YouTube channel and please subscribe. Some of these shorts come from my best-selling book, Grand Canyon Rim to Rim History. You can get my book on Amazon.
Grand Canyon.
Grand Canyon.
Grand Canyon.
Grand Canyon.
In 1896, tourists increased at the south rim of the Grand Canyon. They came by horseback and wagons. Overnight lodging was needed instead of camping at the head of the Bright Angel Trail. Bright Angel Hotel was built in that year by James Thurber, extending a mining camp building put up by prospector and rough rider Bucky O'Neill. The hotel eventually had 8 guest rooms. Tents were put up in rows south of the hotel to accommodate more guests. Bucky O'Neill's cabin, still standing, was later incorporated as part of the hotel, at first connected by a large circus tent. The large hotel reception room was amazing and impressed visitor W.J. Rouse, who said,
"The walls and floors are completely covered with richly colored Navajo Indian rugs and decorated with every conceivable kind of Indian ornaments. The place is at once the most hospitable-looking room I ever entered."
Another man described the end of the long day.
"There was a crush at the Bright Angel Hotel in the evening. Over 100 people were there for dinner. After dinner, the party took possession of one of the long dining room tables and gathered around it to listen to William Bass narrate something of his experiences and observations in the canyon."
In 1901, after the train reached the canyon, Geneva Lane recorded,
"We reached the canyon about 10 o'clock at night. The porters of the Bright Angel Hotel met the train with lanterns and handcarts. I followed a flickering lantern up the hill to the hotel. I stepped into the hotel sitting room. The walls were covered with Indian blankets and skins of wild animals and decorated with deer horns and pictures of the canyon. I was told that owing to the crowded condition of the hotel, I would have to sleep in a tent. My tent stood in a row with several dozen others and was roomy enough and surprisingly comfortable. It had a wooden floor with Indian blankets for rugs."
In May 1903, President Theodore Roosevelt visited the Grand Canyon. After a morning horse ride to Grand View and back, a reception was held at the Bright Angel Hotel, and he made a speech from the deck. He said about the canyon,
"Leave it as it is. You cannot improve upon it. The ages have been at work on it, and man can only mar it. Keep it for your children and your children's children."
The old Bright Angel Hotel was torn down in 1935, but the Bucky O'Neill cabin portion of it still stands.
Grand Canyon.
Grand Canyon.
Grand Canyon.
Grand Canyon.
Louis Boucher was the famed Grand Canyon hermit. He was born in Quebec, Canada, in 1847. After losing his first wife to death and second to divorce, he went to America in 1891 and arrived at the Grand Canyon's South Rim, where he became employed as a trail guide. Boucher claimed land at Dripping Springs below the South Rim, where there was a reliable source of water. He prospected in the area and started to develop the trails. He found a graphite mine nearby that he believed would make him wealthy. His Grand Canyon claims were about 8 miles west of the main activity on the South Rim, above Bright Angel Trail. By 1901, he was referred to as the Grand Canyon Hermit. Yes, he lived alone, but he was not a total recluse. The next year, he worked as a guide for Francois Mathis, who surveyed and mapped the Grand Canyon. Boucher was an active businessman and did not spend all his time at Grand Canyon. For years, he maintained a very large sheep herd in the county, moving it from place to place, and established a ranch in central Arizona where he also mined. As he spent more time at the Grand Canyon, he became one of the respected early old-timers who helped develop the South Rim area. For a time, Boucher was in charge of the camp established down at Indian Garden, now called Havasupai Gardens, and worked as a trail guide. He was recognized as a Grand Canyon celebrity, visited Flagstaff often, and the newspaper would always announce his visits. By 1905, his Grand Canyon holdings were referred to as the Hermit District, and the creek, side canyons, and trails were named after him, including Hermit Creek. He encouraged tourists to descend into the canyon and put up some tents for guests at Dripping Springs. In 1908, Boucher invited visitors to make their way down to the Colorado River on his Silver Bell Trail, now called Boucher Trail. Down about a mile from the river, he built a stone cabin, tents for guests, and established a fruit orchard with oranges, figs, apples, peaches, pears, grapes, and watermelons. Nearby was his bumper copper mine with a 50-foot tunnel into the rock wall. It was reported,
"His trail is the real gateway to the wonders of the canyon and is being used more and more every year. It is a public trail, and Louis is ever ready to show visitors every courtesy when they come his way."
In 1909, as it looked like he would be forced out by developers, Boucher, in his 60s, abandoned his claims, left the canyon, and went to Colorado. The next year, he visited Salt Lake City, Utah, promoting the idea for a railroad to be built to the North Rim. He boasted,
"I was the first man to build a trail from the cliff down to the river on a zigzag course, 7.5 miles long."
He ended up in a small coal mining town in Utah, working on the railroad. He lived to be at least 86 years old and died about 1933. After he left the canyon, the Fred Harvey Company actively marketed the Hermit folklore, and Boucher was named for more canyon features than any other pioneer. In 1961, a park patrol found a coffee grinder and old saddle in his rock cabin by Boucher Creek. They also found shovels in the mine nearby. Thanks to Dick Brown for his excellent research on Louis Boucher.
Grand Canyon.
Grand Canyon.
Grand Canyon.
Grand Canyon.
A long-forgotten tourist resort once existed down in the Grand Canyon from 1914 to 1930 that provided elegant overnight accommodations for up to 50 people. It was called Hermit Camp. Today, only some foundation ruins can be seen that puzzle passing hikers. After the Grand Canyon Hermit, Louis Boucher left the canyon in 1909. The Santa Fe Railroad and the Fred Harvey Company took over control of his former domain about 8 miles west of Grand Canyon Village. They put together grand plans for the first major resort to be established down in the canyon, a decade before Phantom Ranch was established. First, in 1911, an 8-mile road named Hermit Rim Road was built following the rim from Grand Canyon Village to a rest stop they named Hermit's Rest. One tourist, Caroline Ballard of California, wrote,
"This drive makes one shiver all of the way. We went so near the edge that if one of the horses would shy a little, over we would go. I was so shaky I could not talk, and I had to look over among the trees."
Next, Hermit Trail was greatly improved to allow tourists to descend about 8 miles to Hermit Creek and then another mile to the Colorado River. Early hikers on the trail proclaimed that Hermit Trail was a better trail than Bright Angel Trail, although still scary. Emily Howe, of Maine, wrote about her mule trip in 1915 going down Hermit Trail.
"The first mile was down such a steep grade that I thought I should go over my mule's head at every step. I looked down hundreds of feet as we zigzagged along."
Down in the canyon, in 1914, a luxury resort camp was built above Hermit Creek. It included initially a dining hall, mule barn, and 11 canvas cabins. The resort was named Hermit Camp. Looking down from the rim, one man said,
"Hermit Camp looks like the roofs of houses for wrens or other small birds."
The cabins had pine floors, leveled by stone foundations. The sides and roofs were made from canvas. Comfortable beds with fresh linens, an Indian-style rug, chairs, and a small wood stove for cool evenings were highlights of the interior. Some visitors even had electricity, showers, and telephone service. At the heart of the main building was a dining hall fully stocked with fresh produce, meat, and ice. A married couple served as camp hosts. They lived down there year-round and only came up to the rim 4 to 5 times a year. A visitor said,
"Hermit Camp is not an ordinary camp, for it has a chef from Chicago and comfortable beds. The sides and roofs of the tents are of cloth, through which the fresh night air filters."
Typically, tourists would ride on a stage from El Tovar Hotel to Hermit's Rest, where they would stop for a brief rest. Then they would descend Hermit Trail on mules to the camp, hike to the river and back, eat a wonderful supper, stay overnight, and ride back up the next morning. The cost for the trip, meals, and overnight accommodations was $18.25, valued at about $350 today, so most of the visitors were rather wealthy. An aerial tramway was constructed in 1925 from Pima Point to Hermit Camp. It was a great way to bring supplies down to the camp. It was thought to be the longest single-span cableway in the country, 6,300 feet between the top and bottom without intermediate supports. In the late 1920s, Hermit Camp lost priority and attention after Phantom Ranch was opened and became the more attractive destination for tourists who wanted to reach the bottom of the canyon. Hermit Camp experienced a decline in visitors. After a fire destroyed the dining hall in 1930, it was decided to close the camp. It was then left to deteriorate for several years until the Park Service ordered the Fred Harvey Company to dismantle what was left and clean up the area in 1936. The 18 buildings were demolished, and the tramway was dismantled. Lastly, a huge blaze was conducted by the railroad company as it torched anything left.
The flames, leaping high in the darkness, illuminated the canyon depths with an eerie light which covered a 10-mile area. Smoldering ashes marked all that remained of Hermit Camp, picturesque old landmark of the Grand Canyon.
Today, remnants of the long-forgotten camp that delighted hundreds of visitors can be seen that include the building foundations, sidewalks, a cellar, a corral, and the tramway's concrete foundations, steel wheels, and cables.
Grand Canyon!
Grand Canyon!
Grand Canyon!
Today, we take for granted how easy it is to get to the Grand Canyon in our comfortable cars. During the first decade of tourists, they did not have that option and arrived only by train or by horse-drawn stagecoach. In January 1902, the first attempt was made to reach the south rim of the canyon by automobile. Oliver Lippincott was a photographer, artist, and newspaper editor from Los Angeles, California. He was fascinated by the new invention of automobiles. In June 1900, Lippincott and a mechanic were the first to reach Yosemite Valley by automobile. The following year, men in Flagstaff, Arizona, wanted to prove the feasibility of a company being formed for hired auto travel from Flagstaff to the canyon, about 75 miles. An auto company in Ohio was also interested in proving out a new vehicle. Lippincott was chosen for the test ride. The vehicle was a 7.5-horsepower Toledo steam coach, weighing about 2,150 pounds, including contents and passengers. A trailer was pulled containing four extra gas tanks with a total of 32 gallons of gas, 20 gallons of extra water, and photographic equipment, making the trailer weigh 600 pounds. There were plenty of skeptics. It was reported,
"Those familiar with the condition of the country in and about the Grand Canyon will no doubt be amazed that such an apparently foolhardy attempt to traverse it with an automobile should be made."
Thomas Chapman, a newspaper editor, also from Los Angeles, and two other men went with Lippincott. After many delays, they finally started their journey on January 4, 1902. The auto, powered by up to 175 pounds of steam, could reach a speed of 42 miles per hour, but under the heavy load went much more slowly. It was expected that the drive would only take a few hours, but it took 5 days because of breakdowns. The return trip only took 7.5 hours. The journey was considered to be a great success.
"The demonstration is considered one of the most successful and difficult ever attempted."
7 years later, in 1909, the first auto reached the North Rim. Gas was brought in by horse wagon and dropped off ahead of time. It took more years for dirt road improvements to be made, allowing tourist autos to travel to the canyon. Today, nearly 5 million people visit the Grand Canyon in automobiles each year.
Grand Canyon!
Grand Canyon!
Grand Canyon!
Grand Canyon!
A scary cable tram once spanned the Colorado River and was used by travelers to go rim to rim across the Grand Canyon or visit the future site of Phantom Ranch, called Rust Camp. In 1903, D. Woolley of Kanab, Utah formed the Grand Canyon Transportation Company and was given permission to create a rough trail down from the North Rim. It was named Bright Angel Trail, the same name used for the trail coming down from the South Rim. Woolley had a vision of connecting the two trails by building a basket tram, allowing rim-to-rim travel without using a boat to cross the dangerous river. Plans came together in 1905 for a cable tram about 400 feet long and only 40 feet above the river. It would be located near the present-day Black Bridge. In 1906, work began, and materials were brought from Utah on 200 miles of rough wagon roads. The long cable was brought down on the backs of horses. It was a difficult feat to get the procession along the one-foot trail, around the curves, and down the steep descent. By early 1907, the tram was in place and ready for a test. It took a very slow 25 minutes to bring the cage across and back for the first time. Problems were detected and fixes made. Dave Rust, Woolley's son-in-law and tram operator, wrote,
"All goes lovely and jubilant until the car is nearly halfway over. Then buzz, whang, casplash. She sinks out of sight. The river eats it up like the monster she has proved herself."
It took them a week to haul the cage out of the river. Finally, in September 1907, the tram became operational. Photographer Ellsworth Kolb and two young ladies working at El Tovar Hotel were the first passengers. Here is how the cable tram worked. The cage with passengers was moved over first by gravity to its sagging midpoint, and then the rest of the way by using a crank attached to a large drum. Eventually, it became a key attraction in the canyon. However, there was not always an operator stationed there, and disappointed tourists had to return without the river crossing. Cecil Alter of Salt Lake City took a ride in the tram in 1913. He wrote,
"The cage was a latticed human mousetrap with open ends. Jimmy and I got in. Our eyes were as big as owl's eyes. We yelled, 'Let her go,' much as a criminal would signal to the hangman, and the wheels behind the cliff rock anchor began to rattle. We glided out on the sag in the cable to the center of the river, where we swung like a bell in a belfry. Only Jimmy and I were the bell clappers, and we clung to the steel girders of the cage until our hands were red. Why didn't they bolt some doors in the darned cage and lock them?"
Woolley lost his permit for the trail in 1917, and the cable tram was abandoned. One traveler wrote,
"I saw the remains of the old cable cage rested on a ledge, where it had been left stranded, broken, and useless."
Crossings had to be made by boat again for the next 4 years until a swinging suspension bridge was constructed in 1921. The tram's cable is believed to be still in the canyon, just upriver from the current Black Bridge.
Grand Canyon!
Grand Canyon!
Grand Canyon!
Grand Canyon!
Ellsworth and Emery Kolb were originally from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. They became the greatest pioneers of the 20th century Grand Canyon and introduced its wonders to millions of people over more than 70 years. In 1900, at the age of 24, Ellsworth went west to see the world. He had plans to sail to China but went to view the Grand Canyon first and then didn't want to leave. He found employment at Bright Angel Hotel. The next year, he sent money back home to bring his adventuresome younger brother, 21-year-old Emery, to join him at the canyon. Emery, who had been learning photography, arrived with only his camera, harmonica, guitar, and the clothes on his back. In 1904, the two brothers were allowed to establish a studio next to the toll station of Bright Angel Trailhead, where they could take photos of mule trains and offer them for sale. It was reported,
"The studio stands at a dizzy height, right on the edge of the precipice, and a fine view can be had from the windows on the canyon side of the building."
There was a window in the building facing the trail. When a mule wrangler brought tourists to the trailhead, he would ring a bell on the building. One of the Kolbs would open the window and take pictures. In 1906, they built a darkroom building down at Indian Garden, now called Havasupai Gardens. Before water was piped to the South Rim in 1934, the Kolbs had to process the film in this darkroom. Emery recalled,
"For 32 years, I photographed the mule parties that left the rim each morning. Then I would run down the trail to Indian Garden to process my film, then run back up again. It took me an hour down and nearly 2 hours up."
In late 1911 and early 1912, the Kolb brothers made history by boating the river through Grand Canyon. They went into the moving picture business to record their adventure and showed the movie during lectures across the country, and later published a book about their journey. Unfortunately, a rift developed between the two brothers during 1914. They decided it was time for them to go separate ways and flipped a coin to see who would stick with the Grand Canyon business. Emery won that flip. In 1915, Emery made extensive improvements to the Kolb studio, adding an auditorium and additional lab and darkroom space. Both took part in many adventures over the years. Starting in the 1930s, both settled down more, Ellsworth mostly in California, and Emery at the Grand Canyon, where he showed his movies, gave local lectures, and put on social events. In 1960, at the age of 83, Ellsworth died in Los Angeles. He was buried in the Grand Canyon Pioneer Cemetery. In 1975, at the age of 95, Emery said,
"We started showing our pictures in the studio April 15, 1915. So far as we can learn, it's the longest one-stand show in the world."
He estimated that he had photographed 1.5 million mule riders. Emery died in 1976, at the age of 95, and was also buried at the canyon. The studio ownership went to the national park, which had not been keen on the building because it did not match other architecture in the park, but an antiquities law required that it had to be preserved. It still stands today as a museum, gallery, and bookstore. More than 65,000 Kolb images are preserved at Northern Arizona University in Flagstaff, Arizona.
Grand Canyon.
Grand Canyon.
Grand Canyon.
Grand Canyon.
In 1913, former President Theodore Roosevelt announced that he would hide himself from the public view for 2 months in the Grand Canyon, beyond the reach of reporters and out of touch with the wires. He and his two sons, Archie, age 19, and Quentin, age 15, went down Bright Angel Trail on mules on July 15, 1913. To get across the river, they needed to cross over a cable tram, but because of a date mix-up, no operator was there to help. Finally, they flagged down a cattleman who was on the other side of the river, who did his best to help. Roosevelt's nephew Nicholas recalled,
"The cage went very slowly and irregularly, stopping for a minute at a time. I couldn't imagine what was wrong. For several minutes, the car didn't move at all."
The cattleman was exhausted. Theodore Roosevelt took control and cranked the cage over himself for the next group in their party. They went to the future site of Phantom Ranch, which was called Rust Camp, to rest, have dinner, and get some sleep. The cattleman there kindly gave the company enough food for dinner and a breakfast and let them use 2 pack mules and saddle horses for the trip up to the North Rim. They got up very early to continue their journey, guided by the cattleman. Roosevelt wrote,
"In the sultry darkness, which, in spite of the moon, filled the bottom of the stupendous gorge, we started up Bright Angel Canyon, up its boulder-filled bed. Groping and stumbling, we made our blind way along it, and over an hour passed before the first grayness of dawn faintly lighted our footsteps. At last, we left the stream bed, and the trail climbed the sheer slopes and zigzagged upward through the breaks in the cliff walls."
At the North Rim, Roosevelt hired mountain lion hunter Jimmy Owens and frontiersman Buffalo Jones to guide them on their hunt for mountain lions. Owens told the party, "We'll eat off the land, mountain lion meat and wild horse flesh." Roosevelt found out that cougar meat was as tasty as venison. They had some success, bagged a few mountain lions, but spent much of the time searching for their runaway horses and pack animals and trying to stop the hounds from chasing coyotes.
Grand Canyon.
Grand Canyon.
Grand Canyon.
Grand Canyon.
Phantom Ranch is the beautiful oasis at the bottom of the Grand Canyon. It was established in 1922. How did it get its name? As it was being built, it was named Roosevelt Chalet to honor Theodore Roosevelt, who had stayed there overnight in 1913. But before it opened, Mary Coulter renamed it to Phantom Ranch, naming it after nearby Phantom Canyon. Okay, so how did Phantom Canyon get its name? If you Google for the answer or ask a park ranger, you will likely be told.
The name likely originated from the observation that the narrow gorge seemed to appear and reappear in a phantom-like haze, or from the fact that early explorers would miss the creek because it was so hidden.
However, that is a modern, sanitized reason to perhaps hide the true story. In the 1920s, the true story was clear and told over and over again by Phantom Ranch hosts and guides. In 1924, early Phantom Ranch caretaker Noah Kelly explained that a prospector, John Shane, who he knew well, was killed at the mouth of the side canyon. A stone had fallen off the wall and, quote, smashed him flat. When prospectors and hunters were in the area, they kept seeing a strange light on the wall where Shane had been killed. They thought it was spooky, and the canyon was called Phantom Canyon. Kelly, an Irishman, said he had seen this strange phantom light during a storm.
I saw what looked just like someone was carrying a lantern going from place to place. Then it would go out, and in a minute would come again. It sure would, and sometimes it was just awful dim-like and then it would brighten up and the thunder kept on rolling. I just laid in bed and covered up my head. I sure did.
In 1926, visitor Ralph Pearson said,
"That evening at Phantom Ranch, we talked and played cards and hoped that the phantom would appear. Many claim that they have seen a whitish shape flitting around in the recesses on the high cliffs, but I didn't see any sign of the ghost."
In 1927, a correspondent for the Kansas City Star wrote,
"Phantom Ranch is so called for the excellent reason that it has a phantom. I did not see it myself because it appears only to the guilty, but I know it is there because many who have seen it told me about it and described it. Their descriptions do not all agree, but descriptions seldom do, especially for descriptions of phantoms. The phantom appears at night on the face of the mountain."
The reporter had a terrible, sleepless night at the ranch, hearing spooky bell noises all night. The sounds turned out to be caused by some concrete pieces that fell onto a tub on the enclosed porch of his cabin. It is understandable why others in the future did not want people to know the true story of Phantom Ranch's namesake and changed the explanation. After all, who would want to spend the night at a spooky ranch? They did not want to scare away visitors. Many years later, famed Grand Canyon explorer Harvey Butchert also said that near the mouth of the creek, on the cliffs, one could see at times a projection of a cloaked phantom figure. Next time you are at Phantom Ranch at night, go out and look for the phantom.
With that, this is Davy Crockett, and this is the Ultra Running History Podcast. I hope you run fast and far, enjoy life, get outdoors, and most of all, stay safe and don't take unnecessary chances.